They're not going to go over it again, obviously. But the question which arises, and it would be good if you had the Vedic in red. I think we should get to it next Monday, probably. The 6 weeks will be October the 12th. And it will include all the reading on sections 1 and 2 of your assignment sheet. All the readings of 1 and 2 on the assignment sheet for the 6 weeks on October the 12th. That's clear enough. At that time, on October the 12th, you will get the sheet for the 12 weeks. Don't worry about that now. Now, what I had to say last time is actually crucial for what is to come now, for the revolt of youth. So if you missed the last lecture, I can't help it. Because I'm not going to go over it again, obviously. But the question which arises, and which I didn't have time for last time, but which fits in now, with this transition to the revolt of youth, about which I'm going to talk, is why is this so culturally oriented? Culture, to manners, and morals. That is, of course, a very good question. Why is the revolt of youth so much a matter of literature and art, and not, let us say, a matter of the barricades? Now, of course, there was a social revolution brewing, and we shall come to it, the rise of modern socialism. But the cultural phenomena with which we are concerned, you must not forget, takes place entirely within a bourgeois framework. And modern art and literature comes out of this revolt of the bourgeois youth against the bourgeois elders, obviously not out of the rise of socialism, quite obvious. In fact, I think we must say this right now, that when we will come to the rise of modern socialism, you will see that modern socialism could never get any hand or any relation to modern culture. That what the early socialists read was still the classics of the 18th century, and that therefore, for a long time, you might say almost forever, socialism stood apart from the trends of modern culture, and at best accepted popular culture, but never the kind of modern culture, modern art, literature, which we are about to talk, to address ourselves now. Now, obviously, positivism had not only a system of thought which accompanied it, but also art and literature. But the art and literature which accompanied positivism is not so simply characterized. Positivism coincides, of course, has a lot to do with what we can call the rise of naturalism in art. And indeed here, I shall be brief, because you can read that in chapter 11 of The Culture of Western Europe, which is all about the rise of this artistic movement. Now, naturalism in art called for realistic representation of things as they were. Obviously, again, the kind of pragmatism that you have in positivism, and in literature as well. But in art, there is a problem about it. It tended to become, from the beginning, an environmentalism. It tended to become descriptive, to describe the factory workers, to describe the slums, to paint the factory workers, to paint the slums, an environmentalism, really. And this environmentalism, in a sense, tended to become an accusation, was meant, in fact, to become an accusation, and therefore went beyond a positivism to accuse present a bourgeois society. When, for example, as Perry will show you a picture, Baluchek, a painted factory worker, in the first pictures of factory worker, they are naturalistic, but they are also accusing. They are a mask. They are depersonalized. It's an accusation of a society. Or still more important, Gerhard Hauptmann's famous naturalist drama, The Weavers, or Emil Zola's novel Money, you can take your choice. They all are environmentalists. They all want to describe things. The Weavers are about an early revolt among the weavers in Germany in the 1840s. And Money of Zola describes capitalism and his time. But the problem here is clear, I think. It is too much descriptive. As Zola put it in 1878, for example, why is a railroad station, thought to be ugly? As a station, it is in fact beautiful. Or Huysmans in France, who celebrates what he calls the trembling beauty of the locomotive. What you have here is an environmentalism, an acceptance of the results of industrialization. But in naturalism, this is usually bent to an accusation. And in fact, something that comes out of naturalism in Germany and France is something we shall talk about later, is the popular theater, the so-called Volksbühne, the popular theater, theater for the masses, the ancestor of Brecht and Piscator's political theater in the 20s, comes out of naturalism. And yet, typically enough, socialism rejected it. And when it was discussed, for example, in a Socialist Party Congress in 91, it was rejected for a very simple reason. It had no hope. It was too much descriptive. It didn't have the hope of the future within it. And so socialists went back to read the classics, which they thought had such hope in the 18th century, and rejected naturalism. Now, it is clear then that naturalism accompanies positivism uneasily. It is an accusation. It isn't enough of an accusation. For socialism, it ends the hope of the classless society. Indeed, most of the naturalist writers were eventually integrated. Gerhard Hauptmann moved to the right, became a romantic, in the end, in fact, behaved pretty bad under the Nazis. And that happened to many naturalists. They became integrated eventually. And in that, socialism was, of course, quite correct. There was, as Karl Liebknecht put it then, not enough hope for the future. For the real positivist art had to combine two things, which Jenny Tribal combined, and which I talked about last time, naturalism and sentimentality. Art must be at once sacred, but also close to reality. It must be clear, as Nordau said, but also have sentiment. And I'll give you a leading example of this. Namely, a speech by the German Emperor William II. A speech which he made in 1901, opening something that was very famous. His great typical, his great artistic project was to transform a promenade in Berlin's main park into the glory of the House of Hohenzollern, and to have, I think it was 50 statues made of all the Hohenzollerns which framed this promenade, called the Promenade of Victory. And so, still in my youth, thank God the Second War destroyed it, there was in Berlin's chief park this promenade, with one damned Hohenzollern after another, of course, standing side by side, standing, all men, of course, standing side by side, all sculptured according to the taste of the 19th century. As children, of course, when nobody was looking, you can imagine what we did on their feet like dogs. So anyway, now, when in 1901, William II opened this famous Siegesallee, this famous promenade of the Hohenzollerns, of his ancestors, he put it as follows, and I think that describes very well the actual art that went together, the artistic equivalent of Jenny Tribal, if you like. What did Emperor William II say? That art draws on nature, but Mother Nature is not undisciplined. It works according to laws. And the laws are the laws of harmony and order, obviously. The laws of harmony and order. But art must also be upbeat. It must give heroes to the toiling masses. Well, that's what these Hohenzollerns were supposed to be, I suppose. Heroes to the toiling masses of Berlin. It must give heroes to the toiling masses who can elevate themselves to being presented hope and ideas. In this case, as I said, the princes of Hohenzollern in marble. But this hope did not have to be marble. This hope could be, of course, light and sun in painting. And the important thing which I think typifies it is that this is the time of the rediscovery of the Renaissance painter Raphael, who quite rightly, I think, had been in bad repute then, as he is in bad repute now. Because Raphael is too much realism and sweetness and light. So Raphael with his virgin, partly realist, but sentimentalized of sweetness and light, was now, of course, a rediscovery. And you get, therefore, a whole series of painters, now forgotten, but Barry will show you some of the pictures, which combine Haeckel's sentimentality, if you like, realism with sentimentality. And indeed, there is a word that describes it, romantic realism, which you have in Raphael, the kind of succoring sweetness of his Madonnas, and which you now have in these largely forgotten painters, who painted scenes of realism, but at the same time of sentimentality and of a romanticism as well. Here then is the formation of popular taste. These pictures will be very familiar to you, because it is that bourgeois art and literature which hit popular taste and which popular taste accepted, and which is probably the picture that your landlady hangs up, probably comes under the romantic realism, yes? So all you have to do really is to look into your landlady's room and you will find a landscape which illustrates what I've said. I'm quite sure about that. Now, of course, to young people, this romantic realism, which was eventually Nazi art, fascist art, and popular taste, always this combination, like the Siegesallee, this promenade of triumph in Berlin, a combination of this, Barry will show you a picture of Hitler's favorite painter, by the name of Marquardt. In German we call this whole era the Marquardt era. And there, in that picture by Marquardt, which I've now forgotten what it is, which he'll show you, you will see this romanticism and realism. I think it's a Greek theme, sentimentalized, but with a great deal of realism in it as well. Now, all of this, of course, for the young people, seek more sentimentality, raising false hopes. The sun and those things which always shine in these portraits to give you hope. And of course the socialists loved this art. Socialist art because it had realism, it had hope, the sun. People are looking into the sun, walking into the sun, God knows what. Yes? Always painted realistically. Not quite yet the masters of pubic hair, but as Hitler's favorite painter was rightly called, almost masters of pubic hair. But these masters of pubic hair sentimentalized, yes? Sentimentalized, abstracted, yes? Pubic hair walking into the sun. No! What you have, that de-eroticized. See, because erotic is nightmare. Day, you know that. We'll come back to that, why that should be so. You never think why that should be so. Anyhow, the reason for everything. So, the young people, of course, revolted against this. Insincerity, hypocrisy. Now, these young people did not just mount their bicycles, but they now also wrote. They painted, and they acted, and they sought to express their joy in the immediate experience, which in this romantic realism was abstracted again, as you can see, and in naturalism was too much of an environmentalism, was too anti-individualist. So they wanted an immediacy of experience, their joy in speed, and in freedom, their joy in struggle, not against any class, but against their parents. Now this revolt has several levels of intensity. And the two most important levels of intensity I now want to address myself to. One we call impressionism, and the next level of intensity we call expressionism. And both are known in the history of art, and you should know that, as secessionism. Because these young artists usually made their own exhibitions outside the official art. The official art was what I've just described, this sentimentalism or naturalism. So these young impressionists in 1874, the expressionists and futurists in 1910, had their own little gallery. And they seceded from the official academies of art. That's why it's called, these are secessionist movements. But in a broader idea, of course, they are the revolt against official art. But official art is the artistic side of Jenny's triumph. So it's a revolt against everything that I've talked about and that we've done about to now. Now in 1874, in France, Monet and Renoir started, of course, the Impressionist movement. And it is interesting how this was viewed by others. Impressionist was viewed by the Jenny tribals of the day and by the official artists in France and Germany as smut, smudge, common and vulgar. Why? Because the Impressionist chose things from everyday life. And here they're very like the naturalists. They were tired of sentimentality, tired of these dinner parties, of the tribals. And so they went out and didn't paint Greek motifs. All these paintings that Barry will show you have Greek motifs, classical motifs, symbolic motifs, yes? Or religious motifs. And these young people said, we're fed up with it. We want to paint life. But how? They took scenes of everyday life. But they were not naturalists because they accepted the speed of time. And they accepted, therefore, what naturalists did not accept, like positivism, that life is a series of rapidly fleeting sense expressions. In other words, these young painters, the young Renoir, the young Monet, looked at the world through a railway carriage. That's what they really did. And they saw the new speed of communication, the new speed of life. And therefore, they used naturalism as a protest. But they went further as young people, and they used as a protest the speed of time. As Emile Zola, who was in a sense, understood them very well, defined it, I think, very well. Expressionism is a study of light in its thousands compositions and decompositions. In other words, with Impressionism, everything is light, composition and decomposition. Now, this is exactly what Nordau had deplored. When Max Nordau said, the trouble with railway travel is that we must always adjust our senses. Our nerves are ruined. We must, it's a village, and then it's a mountain, and then it's a river, and we must always adjust. The Impressionists accepted that and said, that is what art has to reflect. Art has to reflect the adjustment of senses. And they reflected it through color, if you like, through a study of life, through transitory. And therefore, their nudes were also de-eroticized. It's quite true that the Impressionists first painted nudes, more realistic nudes. They again relativized them through making them part of a color scheme, which led to the idea of speed. Lights and shadows for them was what, let us say, out of the railway carriage is the fleeting impression. Now, this revolt, I say, is one stage, and I say that for a reason, because it is not a spring, it is a gentle revolt, it is an early revolt. It's not naughty children, it's just smutty children. Yes, that's how it was looked at. It's not naughty children, and therefore Impressionism was relatively soon accepted. Because in a sense, as speed, it integrates speed. It integrates speed, it captures it. It integrates it into an ordered composition, quite different than expressionism. It integrates speed into an ordered composition, as you know if you've seen Renoir and Manet and the other impressionists. It integrates it into an ordered composition. And the speed, therefore, is not yet a spring. It's not yet, you know, just a release. It still has a lot of discipline. Order, and it stresses sense impression, but it does not yet stress the senses as erotic. In other words, the Impressionists did not attack manners and morals. Their attack was the best impartial one. They did not really attack manners and morals. Their attack was partial, and it was, if I could put it, a gentle attack. Very gentle. And therefore we must add to it the second gentle attack that was not menacing so much. And the second gentle attack, I must give an odd name, namely the name of dandyism. For the second gentle kind of protest, literary, not artistic, really had to do with a resurrection of individuals against mass industrial society, with an assertion of eccentricity rather than the speed of time, with therefore a kind of narcissism, and art for art's sake, as it is sometimes called. Art for art's sake. Another protest that was even gentler, because it could be called eccentric. Its main people, you know, Oscar Wilde, for example, in England, in Germany, others, Jaglief, and in the best book about them, if you want to read it, by Martin Gilbert, called Children of the Sun. That's what they thought of themselves. Children of the Sun, it becomes quite clear. What this dandyism was then, let us define it a little. It was a cult of youth. of course. So was Impressionism. All of them. A cult of young men. An artistic revolt. In this case, against manners and morals as well. But an artistic revolt which was turned towards an aestheticism. An aestheticism. Some were intensely interested in his person, the actual physical rather than the adornment, the careful toilette, the sense of poise, the whole stance shows his superiority. In other words, superiority through dress and behavior, eccentric dress, eccentric behavior, superiority to occupation with oneself, and I would add superiority through a profound cynicism, a cleverness, of which contrasts to normal. After we all know that Oscar Wilde's main stock in trade was cleverness and cynicism, and that is of course a revolt against positivism as well. The cleverness, the cynicism, the dress, you're the picture of Dorian Gray standing before the mirror for hours and hours, and all of this idea is then art for art's sake. And this movement will occupy us later as well, because it is from the beginning a homosexual movement. So that we can say it is also a protest against manners and morals. You remember the trial of Oscar Wilde, all of that sort of thing. Now, clearly this isn't very threatening, in a sense, because it's an aestheticism. It is even further removed from a true revolution. It is even further removed. Perhaps it threats through its cynicism, but it is the truth that while Impressionism was regarded as smut, Oscar Wilde was accepted in the best society as an eccentric. Just so as 10 years ago, no academic cocktail party could do without its black, and 20 years ago without its Jew, so now you have to have an Oscar Wilde, you know? In other words, it's eccentricity, and so suppose our society tolerates eccentricity, as long as it doesn't go too far. And this didn't go very far, or was it indeed very menacing? But it has another side to it, which is a little more violent. The idea of individual death. It is the famous slogan that I must die because there's nothing else to live for. The quest for experience. And when you've had every experience in life, everything that you can think of, you have slept with women, men, goats, donkeys. You have dressed this way, that way. Yeah? Every part of experience you can take, there's only death. Now that's important, because that is associated now in literature with going back to innocence. And innocence is associated in the English world with flowers. Don't know what flowers to bear. A rose, and above all, the color red. Now that is going to be important, for the image of the aesthete is the dying youth with a rose in his hand, which you will find in quite a lot of the arts of the time. And you will find it eventually even by Jean in his Money Change, the novel, and things like that. These aesthetes wanted every experience, and when they'd had every experience, they had to die. But they died with the symbol of innocence, the symbol of return. This is a kind of cynicism, but it is youth. Youth is always innocent. This is the ultimate worship of youth that you have here. No matter what youth does, in the end, it is always beautiful and innocent. These are children of the sun, and if they have slept with goats and animals and whatever you want, they come out innocent because they are youth. Yes? So, this becomes important in a way that I must mention here. That is why the poppy becomes a symbol of the fallen soldier after the First World War in Britain. As you know, in Britain, the poppy is the symbol, Poppy Day, because red is the color of dying youth. So in the First World War, it will be not only in England, the color eventually for the fallen soldier. And if you go in Europe to war monuments or to the graves of fallen soldiers, they will have roses on them, by and large. Roses or poppy, because from that point of view, red is the color of dying youth. Yes? Of dying youth, which has fulfillment in death. Now this is for the nation. For Oscar Wilde, it was fulfillment in death, because you had every experience life has to give. Like the picture of Dorian Gray, there are others, but at the moment, again, you can read about that. Diaghilev in Germany, it has a lot to do with the rise of the ballet, about which I cannot say anything here. But anyway, you have this idea. Now let me summarize. You have two protests against the bourgeoisie. One is artistic, a group protest, in a way. The Impressionists consider themselves as a band, as a group. Which really was more philosophical. Yes? The speed of time, order, sense, impression, more philosophical. But also not really threatening anybody. They don't want to kill anybody. The second protest is what we must call, we call it dandyism, because the dandy comes from the 18th century, and the dandy is one who pays a lot of attention to his dress, a man who pays a lot of attention to the way he's dressed. Dandyism, or whatever you want to call it, you call it children of the sun, if you like, that's what they call themselves. They call themselves flaming youths, children of the sun, all that sort of thing. And that protest was individualist, highly individualist. It was not it was concerned with the speed, but in a different way. Speed was individualized. Speed for them is not the way you look at nature, but speed is to have every experience life has to offer. Then you die. That's also a sense of speed, of personal, individual speed. And this is informed, if you like, by two things which are part of the process, of the protest. By two things which are part of this kind of process. First of all, the exaltation of youth, youth and beauty, all of it. And secondly, the exaltation of men. In other words, an attack of manners and morals through homosexuality. As yet hidden, but it's of course there. Through homosexuality, an attack on manners and morals as well, and perhaps certainly a deep cynicism. Nothing the hell matters. Just experience matters. That they have with the Impressionists, the idea of experience, of sense impression. Sense impression matters, experience matters. That they have in common with the Impressionists, obviously, but it is personal. They are narcissists. They look at themselves. Dress and so on is important. From these two revolts, we must come to the third, which is for us the most important. For the consequences of Impressionism are not so great. And the consequences of Dandyism, we should come back in the 30s. And I just want to say who continues this, in case you know. It's above all an English thing. That has to do with homosexuality, the English public school, and all of that. And the people who continue that are Christopher Isherwood and Auden, the English poets of the 1930s, 1920s and 30s, what we call the Bloomsbury Group, if you know what that is. We shall come to it eventually. Who will continue this kind of tradition? They will call themselves as well children of the sun. The more important of all is expression. Now why? Why is that so much more portentous? I think it is so much more portentous for two reasons, really. First of all, it is a real revolt. They wanted really to kill their fathers. Yeah? As you will see later, not that they did it, but it is a shriek. It is a revolt in art as well. A shriek, a revolt concerned with soul. It's undisciplined, and it prided itself on being rather undisciplined. And second of all, it is nevertheless both a group and individual. In the last resort, it talks to individualism, I suppose, but they also consider themselves as a group, very much as a group. And finally, they accepted the speed of time without any reservations. Nakedly, not even as seen through sense impression, but as a kind of shriek, as a kind of jumping up, as you will see, into the sky, into the blue yonder, into anything that we can say about it. And finally, they had another side to them, which you don't have in the other. They were based on the revolt of generations. Now, the Impressionists never were so articulate that they were revolting against their parents. They really rather liked their parents, I think. You know? And certainly the dandies, one never hears about parents. Nobody knows who Oscar Wilde's parents were. Well, he had it. So, he had it. So, in a sense, but here the parents matter. This is now a definite revolt of you. And therefore it isn't this art for art's sake, a glorification of the beauty of you. Expressionists, we shall come to that, were eventually concerned with beauty. But they weren't concerned with beauty the way Oscar Wilde or Dorian Gray was concerned with beauty, the beauty of youth, you see, and all of that. They were more concerned with the revolt itself. What then is expressionism? Technically, expressionism is, of course, the name given to an artistic movement which, like Impressionism, revolted against the canvases of the naturalists, but above all, of these bourgeois artists that I talked about, both historical painting, like the promenade there I talked about, or this kind of painting that Perry will show you, romantic realism. Yes? The name Expressionism was coined in 1910. Now, that's an important year for you to remember because you've got to have some idea of dates. Because two important movements we'll talk about related start there. Expressionism in Germany and everywhere else, and Futurism in Italy. And we shall talk both about Expressionism and Futurism. They are, in fact, related movements. Now, why they started in 1910, I haven't the faintest idea. But they started probably to make it more convenient for you to remember the days. So I have no idea why they started in 1910. But there it is. In 1910, they started, as these things start, small way. They in protest, they love gestures, as all young people, as you should know, love gestures. So they walked out of the art exhibitions, and they succeeded, and across the road opened their own exhibition, which was highly shocking, of course. And then they began to write their plays, which were forbidden. It's very typical that expressionism tended to be forbidden by the government. But that didn't happen, by the way, to impressionists at all. And of course, these young art-to-art people neither. Let's remember something here, which I think is important. Oscar Wilde was only indicted for homosexuality by himself, only when he sued for libel. was he indicted. Otherwise, nobody would have bothered him at all. So, the whole Oscar Wilde trial he brought upon himself. So, remember, these people, impressionists, art for art's sake, in a sense, they were eventually regarded as eccentricity. But the expressionists, who talked about the soul, who wanted to murder their fathers, who wrote these awful plays where, in fact, the fathers were murdered on the stage, and who painted these canvases which were abstract art, and properly abstract art, which was new at that point, they were forbidden. They were forbidden for a long time to come and harass. Now the principle of expressionism is stated by the chief expressionist painter, the German Ludwig Kirchner. By the way, all these things, as you know, have their ups and downs. Expressionism is now being rediscovered. It's interesting. It's now being rediscovered. In 1950, you could buy a Kirchner for perhaps $200. Today, he would cost you something like $500,000. So, all these things should have been bought after the war, you're telling me. So, anyhow, stolen it for that matter. Anyhow, the principle was stated by Ludwig Kirchner as follows: grasping everything while it is in motion. The essence of expressionism is in fact restlessness. Restlessness typical of a young generation which wanted to escape the age of respectability, which wanted to escape settled social structure, which refused to integrate itself with the lifestyle of the bourgeoisie. And here's something else that you must now bear in mind, which is vastly important. In 1914, three quarters of the expressionist writers and painters were under 30 years of age. This is a real movement of youth. Three quarters of expressionist writers and painters were under 30. By 1914. And it's after 1914 that there comes a change, and the change, of course, in a sense, you'll see, comes not only with the war, but when they grow up. What is expressionism? Now, very typically, one of the chief early expressionist writers, I won't bother you with the name, Ivan Goll, put it very well. He said, expressionism is not just a counter-movement, it is a state of mind. Now here you have the difference between expressionism in a way and impressionism and dandyism. Expressionist claim is to much more of a totality, much more of a total revolt, an accentuated revolt, and total revolt. And impressionism, which didn't attack manners and morals, whose everyday themes are in a way mediated, and their sting is drawn by these changing sense impressions. Or let me put it this way: impressionism, whose main idea is the speed through sense impressions, the dandies, who are so individualized that they're really no threat, but rather an eccentricity. If you're too individualized, you're no threat. You're an eccentricity. Who cares? So, you're an eccentricity. But who defines speed in very personal terms, having every experience life has to offer. Yourself, not a group experience. Personal experience, as you know, in the picture of Dorian Gray and all that sort of thing, is all what that is about. But expressionism isn't. And this is true for culture. For while impressionism is only painting, there is really no impressionistic writing as such. It is not a proper genre in literature. Impressionism is only painting, and Oscar Wilde is only writing. There is no dandyism in painting, I've ever heard about. Expression is both. It is both painting, it is writing, it is plays, it is every kind of activity. Every kind of activity. A total activity. So you can say that by 1910, the revolt had become more total. Because here you must get chronology right. Impressionists were the first to revolt. Dandies the second. And expressionists the last. So obviously there is a progression. And obviously expressionists and futurists are a much more total revolt. A total revolt. And a total cultural phenomena, or as Ivan Gold said, really a state of mind. That is really what it is, not a counter-movement, but really a state of mind. Now, what was the essence of expressionism? The essence of expressionism was the war between generations. By 1910, bourgeois society was obviously even more settled in its way than 1892. Expressionists regarded this war between generations as a revolution, the only legitimate revolution, as a revolution that would actually lead to change. So what change, we shall come back to, they were never, I'm afraid, very clear on that subject. But it is a war between generations, because the older generation is opposed to movement. It is young against old, vigorous against tired, sons against fathers, youth against age, virility against complacency, potency against impotency. You can oppose all these vocabulary that you will find later on in Nietzsche, the exaltation of virility, the exaltation of potency, the exaltation of dynamism, all of this sort of thing is here combined in young against old, sons against fathers. Eventually people will even talk, you know, about young and old nations, nations which are finished. This war was a brutal war. There is no doubt that the expressionist war was a brutal war, and its essence was in fact death. Death to the fathers. An exaltation of brutality, of blood, of murder, of all of these sort of things were exalted. Partly to shock the bourgeoisie. Underestimate that. This used as a great foible for a shock. And partly also for one of the chief driving motors of this expressionism. And one of the chief driving motors of this expressionism is simply boredom. By 1910, bourgeois youth was bored enough. I'll illustrate that to you on Monday. Bourgeois youth was bored enough that it was willing to murder their fathers, not simply go and dress so as to shock. That wasn't enough anymore to be an eccentric, to be a tolerated eccentric, to be the swan in Proust. It wasn't enough of that, really. You had to go one step further now. And you had, as in Hasenclever's drama, go down to the living room and shoot the father. Because the interesting thing of Hasenclever's drama is that at the moment he shoots the father dies of a heart attack. Typical bourgeois youth. Typical of all bourgeois youth revolts, 68 or now. They always want to have their cake and eat it too. They want to assassinate their fathers, but if they die of a heart attack, that's of course much better. So Hasenclever's drama is typical, I think, of the reality of this expressionist revolt. With that, I will continue on Monday.